Good evening. This evening I'd like to bring you into a conversation that I've taken part in recently, both online and off, because it also seems to be linked to an ongoing conversation of ours as we keep company with each other in our time and ask what helps. How do we meet this time and our very specific lives with open hearts, clear eyes, and ready hands? So the conversation was, this sort of piece of the conversation was sparked by something that David Weinstein posted about a talk he was giving yesterday. I haven't listened to his talk yet, so I don't know where exactly he went with it, but it was an interesting point of departure. So I thought, okay, I'll depart there too and see where it goes for us. So he's been exploring this teacher Banke, who was in the 17th century and had a particular, you know, each teacher actually, I think, but some dramatically, look at the direction Zen or practice is going in their time and go, ah, you know, this needs some work. This has gone off course, right? So Banke was one of those who sort of radically challenged what was going on in his time. And then, you know, 100 years later, Hakuin responded pretty strongly to what Banke was saying. So it's fun to look through the centuries and see that these deeply felt conversations about awakening, about what is effective in us and in our worlds, go on, continue, as we are continuing. So David started from this statement, your idea of wanting to control your passions and delusions is itself delusion. It exchanges an awakened mind for delusion. Exchanges an awakened mind for delusion. So right away, when in that exchange, awakened mind versus delusion, right, you can already see the taking of sides, right? And David goes on to say what the 17th century Japanese Zen teacher Banke calls delusion is what the 20th century Tibetan teacher Lama Yeshe, who was David's first teacher, used to call negative mind. Not negative because it was an unpleasant experience, such as anger or jealousy or greed. Rather, negative because it resulted in negative consequences. So, delusion being a kind of thinking that results in negative consequences. And we've been very much, you know, trucking with these states of mind and compulsions to behavior that we meet as we take up the precepts, you know, once a month in here and in ongoing conversation. So negative because it resulted in negative consequences. My personal favorite of his various ways of addressing delusion or negative mind was when he called it chocolate. He would often say, negative mind, isn't it wonderful, like chocolate? Or when talking about his first trip to a grocery store in America, he told us as he walked down an aisle piled high with all kinds of delicious things to eat, temptations to fulfill greedy desires, he had to pause in awe to say, chocolate. So having had an introduction to meditation, David goes on, that likened delusion to chocolate has left me particularly open to what Bhante is saying about delusions. A meditation practice is not about controlling passions and delusions. It's about becoming a connoisseur of them. So that was David's departure point. And a number of other teachers in the Sambo Kyodan responded to him with, but, you know. And so there was an interesting conversation that went off in its own direction. But anyway, so David says a meditation practice is not about controlling passions and delusions. It's about becoming a connoisseur of them. So this is what I started to bemuse. So there's a koan, I wish I didn't have time to actually go ferret it out, but there's a koan that says something like, before enlightenment, passions and delusions control us after, and use us. After enlightenment, we use them. And I've always thought that's a pretty interesting sort of a statement. We don't talk very much about a before and after kind of thing, and for very good reasons, I think, you know, before and after what enlightenment, you know, that we tend to see enlightenment as an ongoing, at least awakening as an ongoing process, yeah, of enlightenment and darkenment with experiences of each going on. But there is in an opening, in an awakening experience, a kind of before and after also. So we can acknowledge that the world is changed by experiences, both subtle and dramatic, in ways that can affect our lives profoundly, if subtly. So what about this sort of before and after of it? Are we just making another duality? Or is there some interesting observation there about being used by your delusions versus using them? And actually, the Vajrayana tradition in Buddhism is rooted in the understanding that your common everyday delusions, passions and delusions and, you know, mess ups are exactly the stuff, are the gold, you know, are the stuff of your transformation, are the stuff of our transformation, are the stuff of our enlightenment. So that's kind of, in a way, echoing that before and after statement, that being used by versus using, being subject to versus maybe the subject of. Anyway, I digress as usual. So coming back, that there was that koan, and that was basically like that. So thinking about my own experience, I do notice that trying to control passions and delusions tends towards self-obsession. And that self-obsession is built on an attitude of aggression towards my mind. I am taking sides against it in some way. And I'm trying to manipulate it. And in that kind of self-obsession trap, which has the stick of aggression towards mind. That pursuit, that endeavor to get my passions and delusions to behave, leaves my energy controlled effectively by them, right? Leaves my energy controlled by my thoughts. So I was always a pretty pitiful chess player, but when I watched Fred teaching the children to play chess, there was this one phrase that, you know, that really always stuck with me, which is taking the tempo. Any chess players? Having the tempo means that you're controlling where the attention is, and that the other person has to be responding to you. Okay? So, in chess terms, when we are obsessed by trying to get our passions and delusions under control, they have the tempo. Right? They are calling the game. We are just trying to catch up. You know? And they seem to be able to keep us locked in battle with them. So you're at war in some sense. Chess is a war game, right? And another way of looking at it is to say that they're controlling the topic of conversation then, yeah? Like owning all the news stations. They're brilliant at drama, right? Your passions and delusions. They get great ratings. And the thing about getting great ratings is that they are then able to be played on more stations. Right? They're filling your airwaves. And we spend more time with them. Our logical mind knows that we would rather be thinking about something else. Right? So you've got this little, I'd rather not be. Right? I'd rather not be doing this. But we feel like the losers in a fight. Can you connect with that at all? Like, oh please, just let me get this under control because I'm losing this fight. Yeah, they've got me here. But who's the I who wishes to be in control? Who's the I that's losing the fight? Yeah? And who's the opponent? You know, therefore in emptiness there is no, right? No birth, no death, no gain, no loss, not stained, not pure, yeah? But here we are, you know, locked in battle. And so I think part of the but, right, the I'd rather be thinking about something else but, you know, is that we would very much like not to be led around by the nose by our passions and delusions. Right? Do you feel that way? It's like, please, you know, I'd rather not be your slave. So when we feel helpless to resist them, we feel kind of sick. We feel powerless. Yeah, it's a sicky kind of feeling. And less than, unlovely. So I wonder if it's less that we feel the need to control them than that we want not to be controlled by them. And are we seeing these as the only two options? Have we again made two piles? Right? Either they're controlling me or I am controlling them. Those are my options. Yeah? What if we don't have to do that? It's so easy for us to fall into binary thinking like this, isn't it? It's this or that. So what if we explore a different kind of relationship with our thoughts, so many of which we would like to label as passions and delusions? In my experience, being curious about them tends to open the field a bit, because they just arise along with everything else that's arising. The quiet hum of a fan, you know, the cool floor under your feet in the chapel, silence on the altar. And yet, while they're arising along with everything else, they are intimately mine. You know, that's also our experience of it. These are my thoughts, you know, my passions and delusions. And that's very peculiar. How what is that? You know, what, how is it mine? You know, I think that it's not a mistake to notice the weirdness of that. And since I tend to be mainly blind to them, and come on in, guys, welcome. And to react to them without even knowing it, then it behooves me to become, as David says, a connoisseur. Did you follow that? No?
Not quite.
Okay. So those thoughts, the passions and delusions and all the thoughts, Ben knows what he's doing. They'll find their way in. Yeah, they'll be all right. Yeah. So since those particular thoughts, right, that I'm calling passions and delusions, seem to be so intimately mine, right? And since most of the time I'm blind to them, right? Most of the time they're not visible to me, and I'm just, you know, but then every so often I notice that I'm acting from them, or reacting from them. Then it makes sense to get to know them better. That's all, right? And that's the becoming a connoisseur. And so there's one more sort of step about becoming a connoisseur. So let's look at what's the connoisseur's perspective, right? About passions and delusions, about thoughts like that. And what I noticed is that seen from this perspective, passions and delusions are endlessly inventive expressions of the interpermeation of all of us. So, if I am taking the attitude of connoisseur, right, I can in a way admire them as endlessly inventive creations, right? Expressions of the very interpermeation that we think they are denying. So we think that all of those passions of, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are about, you know, separation and not connectedness. But they arise in a field of total connectedness, which is the only field we've got. Right? And so in some way, they are a creation, a very inventive response to the actual connectedness that we experience. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. So if I'm a connoisseur, then I'm going to go, whoa, that was a good one. You know, I took the fact that the two of us were sitting here right next to us and right next to each other, and this is my sister, and somehow it became, you know, how could she be like this? You know? But it's really a story about connectedness, not disconnection. Underneath. Yeah? So it's sort of looking at the flip side of it. You can just admire the creativity of all of our inventions like that. Our ways to try to wiggle out of our illusions. Of our own impermanence, our own connectedness, our own brief lives. So, So then they are expressions of the fact that I'm affected, I'm touched, yeah, even entered by what comes to meet me. I actually don't have any defense against it because it's me. I'm made of it, it's made of me, right? And something in me that I don't understand all that well responds before I know it, for the most part, right? And science is confirming this all the time, that our responses come way before our explanations for our responses. And how wild and tasty is that? Yeah. We can certainly become a connoisseur of the wildness of the mind. So, I don't know for sure, but I think that I can get close and familiar with these responses without so much trying to figure them out. Right? The trying to figure them out part is just making more stories about them. But there is a way that I can get really familiar with the tendencies of my own particular, whatever we call mine, yeah? This particular being. Without it having to be about figuring it out. You know? You actually, we have this thing about knowing ourselves and knowing other people, but the knowing that's real has nothing to do with how we analyze. Yeah? So when you lose somebody, like when my brother died, you know, what was so apparent to me was that the way I knew him had nothing, it was inexpressible, you know? I just knew him, you know? And that's what I'm talking about. We also know ourselves in that way. And we can, if we're willing to meet our own responses with that just and loving gaze, and be curious, be connoisseurs, we can kind of collect them in our pool of experience. And there's something sweet about that. And then they, I think, can reveal the open spaces in the weave of suffering that we love to hate. Those understandings, that deep kind of knowing. When we meet our own responses with sympathy, with friendliness, with an open kind of friendliness and curiosity, then suddenly the spaces show up. The moments when we're not calling something delusion, when it's just a thought that occurred. And who knows where it might go? Because does that make any sense to you, that there's a space in which we don't have to be judging it? And that space is actually huge. It's the gap in which we're totally free. Because where there's interest, a warm and friendly interest, there's space. So I can wonder, look how the faults and the foibles of my closest friends and family drive me nuts, while the foibles of the squirrel in my pine trees are just endlessly amusing. And the hawk mama tearing apart some small rodent to feed her babies doesn't offend me at all. You know, she's just feeding her babies. What about an octocule? You know, that's just not present, right? But in other areas, it's very present. So what if, heartbreaking as it is, the world doesn't have to live up to my requirements? What if, heartbreaking as I am, Sarah also doesn't have to live up to my requirements? What if I can be interested in what she'll learn? How she'll move on from the latest creative disaster? It's a different relationship.
Yeah.
Part two. How are you doing? You can follow. You'll go a little farther. Okay, so then what might a different relationship be like? That's where I want to go with part two. For me, there is a link to a story that I sort of don't want to tell the whole story, but the koan is Tengai's heart binding, and some of you have heard me talk about it before or have come across it. So it's to me a fascinating story in the context of right now, but the sort of end of it, the sort of punchline part, has a there's the abbot of a temple named Tengai who has taken in a whole bunch of prisoners who were going to be burned to death in the cave where they were being held, and has said, "I will. Don't worry. We don't need chains for this. I will bind them with this rosary, with this mala." And so the subject came up of how can you bind all of these bad guys with this mala. And he says, "I'll bind their hearts. I bind their hearts." And it, in fact, works out that way. And so then the Hatayama Yoshinori, who was a pupil of his and an official in charge of prisons, comes to him, okay, and says, "Do you use a long rope to restrain these criminals?" And he says, Tengai says, "Does your honor use a long rope to restrain criminals? It will indeed serve to restrain their bodies, but to bind their hearts, 1 inch of cord is more than enough. If your honor and the other officers bind the hearts of the wrongdoers, they will respect and obey you, and many will reform and turn to good." And apparently that was exactly what had happened. And Hatayama says, "Well, how do you do that?" And the teacher says, "People have in their inner heart evildoers, who knows how many hundreds or thousands, in revolt against the Lord of the heart. If you don't bind them by Zen meditation and ultimately kill them by prajna wisdom, there will never be true peace there." So here we've got the language of battle, haven't we? Which is what I'm kind of reacting to, but see where this goes. The pupil said, "Now, if the officer's asking how he may bind the hearts of others, let him first bind his own heart." And Hatayama says, how am I to bind my own heart?" And Tengai says, "Lord Hatayama." And he answers, "Yes." The teacher said, "Bind the asking." So for me, when we're looking at what might this new relationship be like, that's where this bind the asking comes in for me. And I'm quite interested in it. You know, I can't even begin to number the cast of characters in my own heart mind, right? We, you know, as Whitman says, we contain multitudes. But I can refrain from rejecting them. And this is where the different relationship comes in. Yeah? I can stay close. I can stay bound. Connected, committed in a way. That kind of binding is a kind of the commitment of our hearts. It's what I think is bodhicitta. It's the where our vow to awaken so that we can all awaken together comes in. That's a kind of binding in my way of understanding it. And I think of Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, who was utterly in his life bound to to finding justice and peace ultimately. So I can notice, so I can stay close, I can stay bound in that way. A kind of real close connection to all of the whole cast of characters. And I can notice that they arise in a very large field. And I think this is quite important, to notice that all around, you know, in the midst of and all around all of those characters that show up internally is space, a lot of space. And that large field invites me to wonder at the whole scene, to find the open spaces and send my energy there, where something new can happen, where there's wiggle room, lots. I really don't know who's binding and who's being bound, and I don't think I have to. I don't think I can or have to. But when we sing, "I vow to set endless heartache to rest," that calls up for me the image of, you know, holding a squalling baby Buddha, you know, not the image of doing battle. And, you know, tending a squalling baby may not be very much fun, but, you know, it tends to turn out okay. So here's a relationship that feels to me more like, in Christian terms, you know, that blessed be the ties that bind, that bind our hearts in Christian love, is how that song goes. And it's one that I think, in reaction to Christianity, we sometimes can react against, you know, the ties that bind our hearts in Christian love. Oh, come on, you know. But actually, I think that's really what we're talking about when we talk about our bodhisattva vow. You know, that we are willing to bind our fates together. You know, I'll bind myself to your fate. Because we only can awaken together. That's the only kind of awakening there is. So, is that binding? I would leave that question in your hands. And so, part three. So just to really encourage, invite you to be curious about what other kinds of relationships. So I'm just giving you a for instance, or, you know, but investigate. So then part three is coming out of the news. Mary Kay, who's a friend of our Sangha, sent a link to this article about the assistant coach of the boys in Thailand. The abbot of the temple where he had been staying often sent in a little tiny tube a note in with one of the divers to the assistant coach who was sitting with the boys. And the note said, "Be patient. Try to build your encouragement from the inside. This energy will give you the power to survive." Be patient. Try to build your encouragement from the inside. This energy will give you the power to survive. So the more I read about that situation, the more complex it is. You know, it is not a simple deal at all. Apparently, like 180 or so rice farmers had their crop completely destroyed by all the water that got pumped out of that cave to save the boys. 180 rice farmers' crops completely destroyed.
I didn't know that.
There's a complex world for you. Mm-hmm. Talk about interpermeation. Mm-hmm. And this rallying of people, of love, of knowledge and equipment and resources from near and far really just so much wanting to save those boys. Mm-hmm. Those boys who were, a number of them were stateless. They were kids, they were not, you know, well off kids from the center of society. They were very much from the edges of society. Mm-hmm. There. And, but these words were addressed to the assistant coach who was in there with those boys. Yeah? Hanging in with them. And so I just kind of love that as an example, yeah, of how when we sort of go after our passions and our delusions, each moment of our lives is that complex. Yeah? There's always a whole universe going on. And yet, when we want to help each other and ourselves, one kind of relationship to have with our minds and with each other's minds is that kind of relationship that just speaks the words that want to be spoken at that time. Yeah, words of encouragement. Be patient. No longer in chess here, right? We're not at war. We're building. We're strengthening patiently, lovingly. Be patient. Try to build your encouragement from the inside. This energy will give you the power to survive. Thinking I might need to tack those words above my computer screen.